The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
And welcome to, hello America, welcome to the Glenn Beck program. It's Jason Chaffetz's story where he is not going to run for Congress. And now he came out and said, I may not even finish this term of Congress. Well, what's happening there? What's happening there? Is somebody coming after Jason Chaffetz? Because he's been a bulldog lately and, you know, for the last couple of years. Does somebody have something on Jason Chaffetz and they are chasing him out? Has he hit a tripwire someplace?
They're also speculating it's possible that he's trying to angle for a Supreme Court nomination.
I had heard governor. No,
governor too. Governor. Governor's another one.
But he said Supreme Court nomination.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I don't think that's a good idea. Wow, really?
That's
all right. We'll get into that. Also, big election over in Europe, in France this weekend. This is really important. This could actually change the dynamics of the world this Sunday. We'll give you the information on that. But I want to start with the New England Patriots and the New York Times. There is a feud, a Twitter war, if you will, going on between the two. I think there is a true hero in this. You won't believe who the hero really is. A true hero and an answer to who's really responsible for the press. Who's really responsible for the fake news? Is it the press? Wait until you really dig into this story. We do it right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck program.
We have the School of Greatness coming up today. We also have Dinesh D'Souza's wife going to be joining us in hour three. She's Venezuelan. She's from Venezuela. The stuff that is happening in Venezuela is truly terrifying. And what really pisses me off is the way the press is dealing with this. They're saying that this is the result of a populist presidency.
I believe she still has family there as well. So.
Yeah, no, it's a dangerous situation. She's going to give us the inside look on Venezuela. But you need to understand that this was a dictatorship. This was a socialist utopia. Here was a great country that went into socialism. And now, have you heard the deal on their gold? Now the president of Venezuela, he first went in, I think it was about a year ago, and went to, is it Citibank? Went to somebody and said, I want to lease the gold to you. I want to take some of the gold for cash, for U.S. dollars, and I want you to give me the dollars, but I have the right to buy it back. And they said, okay, we'll take that as collateral. Now he's going and he's, I'm not sure if it's a bank. I think it's still his city. And he's saying, I'm going to outright sell all of the gold for U.S. dollars so he can infuse cash into their system. And it's a heist. No dictator ever takes that much money and then gives it all away and pumps it into the... It's a robbery of Venezuela.
Wow.
So really, really bad stuff happening in Venezuela, and that kind of stuff spreads, unfortunately. I want to talk to you a little bit about fake news and the press. And I'm going to show you a hero, a villain. I'm going to show you a mistake and the truth. And some of it you're going to cheer for. Some of it you're really not going to like. But I guarantee you, this will open your eyes, if you're willing to look at the stuff you like and don't like, this will open your eyes on who's at fault here. What's happening to our society and who's at fault? Let's start with the New England Patriots. They went to the White House to go with President Trump. And the big thing was, oh, look at the New England Patriots. They're not going to have their, not all of them are showing up to have their picture taken with Donald Trump. When Barack Obama was there, everybody was there.
So the New York Times Sports decided to tweet a picture, side-by-side picture, of the crowd of the Patriots in 2015 versus the crowd in 2017.
And what with the president in the middle.
With the president in the middle, and the exact same backdrop. And when, what you see is in 2017, there's a small gathering of players in front of the White House, well, behind the White House. And then there are staircases that go up the sides. And in 2015, those staircases are full. There's people all up and down, obviously much more interest in seeing Barack Obama than Donald Trump, because in 2017, there's almost nobody, there's no one on the staircases at all, and there's definitely a much smaller crowd.
Okay, so
that's what they tweeted.
The New York Times is trying to make the point, and a typical New York Times, typical failed New York Times, is trying to make it look like nobody wants to have their picture taken with Donald Trump.
Right.
Here's what happens.
So the New England Patriots tweet, these photos lack context. Facts, in 2015, over 40 football staff were on the stairs. In 2017, they were seated on the South Lawn. So the picture does not reflect the entire crowd. In fact, they tweet another picture where the staff is there.
In 2017,
and it not only does it go up the stairs on the side, it wraps all the way around the back. That picture that they tweeted has more people than the Barack Obama picture of 2015.
Okay, so now you can say, fake news, New York Times. Look at what the New York Times is doing. How many times was the New York Times, how many times was it retweeted that original picture of Donald Trump looking like a loser?
I don't have the exact amount, but it was in the tens of thousands.
Tens of thousands of people retweeted that picture basically to say, ha, 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 it felt good.
Trump sucks. Obama was better.
Obama is great. And it feels good. Tens of thousands of people retweeted it. And the New York Times knew what they were doing. Or did they? Here's what the guy who made the decision, the sports editor who made the decision to tweet those two pictures, tweeted once the Patriots came out and said, no, you've got the story wrong. Here's what he tweeted.
He actually responded to a reporter asking him about what he said. And this is what he said. Bad tweet by me. Terrible tweet. I wish I could say it's complicated, but no, this one is pretty straightforward. I'm an idiot. It was my idea, it was my execution, it was my blunder. I made a decision in about 4 minutes that clearly warranted much more time. Once we learned, we tried to fix everything as much as possible, as swiftly as possible, and as transparently as possible. Of course, at that point, the damage was done. I just needed to own it.
Wow, is that great.
Is that the greatest apology you've ever heard?
It's a real one. That's a real apology.
Great.
That guy is my one of my new heroes.
It's a stand-up guy.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Stand-up guy. Just saying, look, man, I own it. It's my fault. It was 4 minutes I made this. Not even saying it was a little deal, big deal. No, I own it. Huge mistake.
Everybody else, almost anybody else would have done that. They'd be like, oh, okay, get over it.
Right. It was just a stupid picture. I made a mistake, No, this is a guy that I want. I'm going to post this story up at glenbeck.com today. This is a guy I want you to talk about at your dinner table tonight with your family. I want you to read that tweet to your children and say, that's the way you own it. That's the way you make an apology.
Because we've all made mistakes like
all of
that,
us.
Right? We've all jumped to a conclusion that was incorrect. There's a point to be made here that, you know, seemingly he wanted to see that, right? Like, you know, somewhere in his mind, he thought that impression was true. And he's like, wow, look at that. And wanted to put it out there and make sure people knew that, hey, these crowds did not compare.
And the only reason why we say he wanted to do that is because he works for the New York Times. We don't know anything about him.
We don't know. But for some reason, he jumped to that conclusion without checking it.
Right, but this shows, because he's surrounded by people who think that, this shows, I don't care what I think. It doesn't matter what I think. It's the truth. What's his name?
I don't know, actually.
We've got to find out his name.
New York Times sports editor. A reporter contacted him. who did it. So I can.
Did you find out? Is Keith around? Did anybody find out? Because I asked yesterday if we could get this guy on the air. Have we tried?
I know we are trying. There was some confusion over what
which one it was.
Details.
Okay.
All right.
So.
But the issue.
Please find out, Keith. Please find out his name so I can talk about it. You have it?
It's not.
New York Times sports editor Jason Stallman took full responsibility.
There we go.
Yeah, Jason Stallman.
Congratulations, Jason Stallman. If you can find his Twitter handle, you should tweet this and tweet, good job. Here's a guy, I haven't heard an apology like that in how long? Ever?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, that's a great thing. Now, here's the problem. As he said,
the damage was done.
Mm-hmm. Now, wait a minute. How is the damage done? We used to say, corrections in the New York Times, they run on the back page. Nobody sees the back page. They run in a little teeny section. It was the headline. They're not going to correct it with the same headline. New York Times, wrong. Well, wait a minute. This isn't a newspaper. This is digital. They're giving it the same 144 characters from the same guy, from the same source, to the same people. So now we can see, because it is truly apples to apples. Mm-hmm. We're comparing the incorrect story and its impact of tens of thousands of retweets. And we'll see who the fake news people are. Did those people retweet, oh crap, I just sent on to all my followers, I just sent on a fake news story.
All right. Do I have any responsibility for doing, or at least a responsibility to correct it? To be clear, what the New York Times did is not, they retweeted the exact tweet from the Patriots that I just mentioned. So they actually said, oh, by the way, we were wrong. Here's the evidence from the Patriots saying we were wrong. And then they went in to talk about how the delegation was. Their quote was roughly the same. Okay. And this is just a snapshot in time. I don't have the current numbers. At one point, though, that night, the first tweet of the two pictures where it looked like Trump looked bad had 32,000 retweets. The correction had 54. Not 54,000.
54.
32,000 to 54.
Okay. So, whose fault is that? And we see this in the conservative realm.
You do?
I will tweet something out that feels good. I'll tweet something out that's true, but doesn't feel good. No likes, no retweets, nothing. Nothing. Whose fault is the fake news? In this particular case, whose fault is the fake news? It's not the New York Times. It's not the New York Times editor. They're all skewed. No,
They made a mistake, and that happens.
It's you minus 54 people.
Right, and when you say you, in this particular instance, it's the left.
It's the left.
The left is the one that's excited about
correct.
That one. They're the one retweeting.
Correct.
And this idea that the left has no appetite for fake news, I think, is pretty well disproved right here.
Right here. Right here. You are retweeting. And again, as Stu said, I guess I should point that out. I just assume we all understand that. I don't think any of us are following the New York Times. You know, we're not like, I like and follow the New York Times on Twitter. So I think that's probably pretty low in our audience that you got that and then retweeted it. But anybody who did, you're following the New York Times and you retweeted this the first time and didn't retweet the correction, you are the problem. And every time that happens on our side, you are the problem.
Yeah.
It's as long as it's corrected and it's on Twitter, because that's apples to apples. Like we always say we lead with our mistakes. Most people don't. They won't put the headline right at the top. We put the headline right at the top. Try to do that. That's still not the same because we may have chewed on something for, 20 minutes and the correction only takes three. With Twitter, it's 144 to 144. It's the same space going to exactly the same people. It's not the press. And I will tell you, I mean, it is the press, but it is the people who are consuming it that are spreading it.
And you know, look, this guy at the New York Times who actually apologizes and takes responsibility, that person doesn't exist at name your random partisan hack fake news website.
Nope.
They just want the 32,000 retweets. They don't even bother with the correction.
Yep.
So it's a huge thing. And I think it's important for us as conservatives, as people who actually try to execute principles every day, to when you see someone on the other side take a step like that, it's important
to say
to make a big deal
you.
Out of it. It is.
This is important for us to retweet because it shows, because I am convinced a lot of this nonsense is because we're not listening to each other. A lot of this nonsense is because we assume the worst of each other. And we're not following the New York Times. And because we don't follow the New York Times, we didn't see them just correct this. And we didn't see a heroic move of a guy who, you know, there are people in the New York Times who were like, just leave it. It doesn't matter. I mean, what are you doing helping him out, right? You know there were people that said that to him in the cafeteria. Yeah. We need to get to the point to where we can point out the heroes on both sides. And when we listen to each other, when we actually... We just assume the New York Times is always going to be unfair. We just assume CNN is just going to be unfair. They just assume Fox News and talk radio is going to be unfair. They put this show into the same category as Alex Jones. Well, that's because you don't listen to us and you don't listen to Alex Jones. That's why. You don't know the difference. We need to do it.
The Glenn Beck Program.
The fusion of entertainment and enlightenment.
We are one. The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury. You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
All right, there's a huge, very important election happening in France this weekend, and I'll explain why it's important here in about 5 minutes. But as we're on about misinformation and fake news, there are 13 times misinformation has been spread during the French presidential campaign. And it's pretty amazing what's going on. And all of the supporters of each candidate, they are taking these fake news stories and they are retweeting them. First one is that Emmanuel Macron's campaign was funded by Saudi Arabia. Not true. Old photos repurposed claim a firefighter was assaulted by thugs and the media ignored the story. Not true. Marine Le Pen shocked by a veil worn by a little girl in a Russian cartoon trying to make her look horrible. Not true. All of these stories are really truly affecting the French campaign, and this could mean very bad things for the West. More on that next.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury. The Glenn Beck Program.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Glenn Beck Program. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the French elections and why you need to be aware of the French elections. And quite honestly, pray about the French elections. You know, we don't pay attention to other people's elections. They pay attention to ours because they know America affects the world. France will affect the world. This election is critical because there's a chance they are going to pick between a fascist nationalist and a communist nationalist. This weekend, they have... what is it? Rolling it down to six people, I think it is. I can't remember. Rolling it down to about six people. They have different kinds of elections. You have to have 50% to win. If nobody wins with 50% this weekend, which is highly unlikely.
Highly likely never happened.
Yeah. So it's just not going to happen. But it could. If nobody wins with 50% this weekend, then it will go into a runoff between the top two. The problem is there's so much fake news, and there is so much there's so much scandal in politics. Nobody likes anybody. Nobody likes anybody. Except there are two people that are coming to the top, and that is, one, the communist nationalist, and his name is Jean-Luc Mélenchon. He is full-fledged, not socialist, he's a communist. He having a communist rule France will change everything. The other one is Marine Le Pen. She is a fascist nationalist. Both of them want to change the alliance with the United States and switch it to Russia. So both of them want out of NATO. They want out of the Western world. They want to throw in their lot with Russia. This is, you remember when I was on Fox News, and I promoted a little book, a little blue book that I thought everybody should read, The Coming Insurrection. That was French. And what the point of that was, and I said, we're going to get to this point. What's happening in France is coming here. It's the same seeds. What that book was about was people are tired of the lies of the politicians. They're tired of the progressive lie, saying, oh, we're going to get there. They're tired of the liberal lie, as we understand liberalism. And they don't believe the conservative lie either. And so this book was put together that said, it's time for revolution. Enough is enough. It's time for revolution. There are enough people that have had it in France that if the top two are Mélenchon and Le Pen, the world changes no matter which one of those two win. If those are the top two finalists.
It's almost certain that they're going to be the top two, isn't it?
I mean, no, there's four really tight.
Yeah, it's pretty tight.
Four candidates, very tight.
Like, because there doesn't seem to be any good option there.
No, there's not.
All four of them seem bad.
They're all crappy.
Really bad.
Some of them are traditional French crappy, though.
Yeah.
The other two are bad, but...
But remember what happened here. This is what's happening. The crappy ones that are just their, you know, it's all cronyism. It's a typical politician. People are so done with the typical politicians that the argument in France is, I just want to burn down the whole system. I just start over. These guys, they're all bad. Sounds I want somebody to go in there and drain the swamp and clean it all out.
Same attitude is here.
Sounds familiar?
Yeah.
It is exactly the same thing, except they're voting between a fascist and a communist. We didn't do that. Now the argument this time is for the other three candidates that are not fascists and communists, they're just bad politicians. They're saying you got to vote for us. You got to coalesce around one of us because otherwise you're going to have these top two. I don't see that working. Now, hopefully it does, but I don't see that working. I see the communist and the socialist who are so sick of it coalescing around the Marxist. And the people who live in the countrysides of France and are tired of their country being mocked, laughed at, getting last in line, and seeing all of these Muslim no-go zones, they're all going to coalesce around Marine Le Pen. And you have a chance of those two, and I hope it's wrong. I hope this is wrong. But it changes the West and puts us, I believe, one step, perhaps more, towards a global war. So congratulations. Last week it was just worried about vaporization of Seoul, South Korea. And this week it's just about the end of the West with France and the end of NATO.
We got through it last week. Maybe we'll get through it.
Yeah, maybe we'll get through it this week.
That's a little bit of optimism. Huh?
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow, that was great,
right,
Pat.
I'm a little ray of sunshine.
I have my gut tells me that they're not. It's not. We're not going to be facing this on Monday, but I don't have anything to base that on except my gut, and that might just be wishful thinking. I don't know. Did you guys see the show last TV show last night? Terrifying. Mm. So you
I'm
know,
sorry, I missed that.
Yeah, I know.
I'd love to be verified.
This one,
I love it.
This oh, one, I'm yeah, inviting. Right. I'm inviting this woman in. Hopefully this week. She is Richard. Oh shoot, what's his name? He was the president of the Dallas Fed. You know, Richard.
All you had think this of issue Spencer, yesterday was Richard
yeah,
Spencer.
Yeah, I know. It's not Richard Spencer. He's the Nazi. She was working at the Dallas. She was working on Wall Street. 2001 happened, and she moved away from New York because she wanted to be safe, and she was sick of the corruption on Wall Street. She was like, this is just sick. She comes down here. She starts exposing Wall Street for what it is through the Dallas Morning News. The head of the Dallas Fed reads her stuff and is like, this woman's really sharp.
Is it Robert Kaplan?
No.
Oh.
Former.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm positive. It's Richard Fisher. Okay. Thank you, Richard Fisher. Richard, I think, is a really good guy. He doesn't believe the same stuff I do, per se, but I think he's a good guy. He's just in the system, or was. So he sees her stuff and he says, wow, she's brave. She's exposing a lot of stuff on Wall Street. Let's bring her in as an intern to the Fed. She's in there, and this is like 2002 to 2007. And she's doing all kinds of research for the Fed, and she's saying this whole thing's going to collapse. This is a nightmare. It's going to collapse. Don't you see the bubble and the tranches and the CDOs? This is all a game. And everybody in the Fed mocked her. She's pregnant with twins. She leaves to go out and have her twins. She has her twins. The market collapses. And Richard calls her and says, I don't want you to be an intern anymore. I need you to be my right-hand person. So she becomes his right-hand person for all of the research for the Dallas Fed. And she finally just left the Fed. He's left the Fed. She left the Fed. And she's now exposing it. And the book is called Fed Up. And she's written it for people like us. It's not Fed talk. It's not written for the people in New York or in banking. It's written for us to understand what's happening. Oh my gosh, guys. She is, when I said, I think we're going to go to a digital currency. She's like, oh, Glenn. Absolutely. And they're trapping your money. She said, it's all being laid right now. And they're all open about it. It's not a conspiracy. They're all open about it. They are going to trap your money because it's the only way they see. And she said they're open about it. She was quoting the people. And she's like, look, I don't believe in conspiracy theories. There's no star chamber. The Bilderberg stuff is nonsense. She said these are just bad, corrupt, greedy people who are doing the right thing. And she said, and the good guys are just doing the right thing for the shareholders. And she said, and that's wrong at this point. You got to do the right thing for the country and the world, not the shareholders. She said, so it's just greed that's driving it all. And she said, it's out of control. And she's warning collapse. And she was talking about solution, what you need to do to prepare. She's the woman I've been waiting for. You know, we found two people now, Chris Martinson, who is really good, that we can explain what's coming. She's on the inside, or was on the inside, for 15 years between Wall Street and the Fed. And she can explain it. And she was big on MSNBC, CNBC. She was big on CNBC. But as soon as she started to say all of the things that she's saying, now nobody wants to talk to her. And she said, I'm an absolute pariah.
Yeah, people don't like to hear that the whole system's going to collapse. It's weird that way.
Yeah, they're strange people that don't want to hear their life is going to end.
It's weird that they don't want to hear that life is going to end as we know it. It's
she's
strange,
saying,
isn't it? Because I enjoy it. I enjoy it a lot.
She's saying it's not that. She's actually, she has valid points on how to get through it. She's like, look, you just have to learn from our grandparents.
We should know about it so we can prepare.
Right.
Got to be prepared.
I asked her, I said, so would you buy a house today? And she's like, absolutely not.
Oh, good.
Great.
Oh, good. Good.
Thank you.
Good. Thank you.
Awesome.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful time. Thank you.
I said, would you sell your house. She said, I wouldn't get into any long-term investing. She said, anybody who is talking to you about long-term investments, she said, there's not going to be enough time.
She recommend taking money out of banks?
Not yet, no. She said, but you need to watch it closely.
I mean, you wouldn't want to create a run on the banks either.
Right. But. She said, you know, because somebody asked that question in the audience, you know, should I take my money out of the bank? She's like, no. She said, it's not happening yet, but it's going to. And she said,
what is her timeline?
She said I think I asked her and she kind of hedged on that, you know, because nobody knows. And I said,
so I'm ahead of the game. Don't save anything. Yeah, right. Don't invest.
Right.
Jeffy's winning for once.
You are, so way to go.
Yeah.
Way to go.
Yeah.
She said the same thing.
She's paying off finally.
She said the same thing. She brought it up to me in the makeup room. She brought it up to me. She said, Glenn, people are going to come with torches and clubs. She said, I was at the mall yesterday. She just wrote an article on the new Gilded Age in America. She said, I was at the mall here in Dallas, and she said, I saw three Rolls Royces. Three. And she said, I thought maybe, is this one Rolls Royce that just keeps going around the corner? She's like, no, there were three Rolls Royces people driving. She said, I went back and I looked it up. Do you know that the sales of Rolls Royce since the election has gone up, what was it, 97%? Anybody remember that?
Hey, well, this neck of the woods what it was has.
It? Oh, I believe it.
67%.
Look around Dallas. Yeah. We've got to be the luxury car capital of the planet.
Oh, yeah.
I know sales must have gone up 8,000% of four-door Maseratis because that's all I see.
Right.
Yeah, Maseratis, and she's saying, Teslas.
What she said was, you know, she didn't have a problem with wealth, but she said, I'm standing there in the parking lot and I'm thinking to myself, do these people not get it? They're going to come and drag you out of that car and kill you. And it reminded me of a story that Jay Leno told me when I was in his, you know, Jay's garage. And Rafe was running towards this $3 million classic.
I remember it was a Bugatti, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a Bugatti. Yeah. Were you guys there with me?
Yeah, I was there, yeah.
So remember when he was running? Do you remember the story he told about that Bugatti? That Bugatti was like a 27 and 29 Bugatti, okay? Really expensive at the time. And it was owned by somebody in New York. And he said the guy stopped driving it. And remember, it had been, they found it like on a farm and it had been used to like pull stuff or a truck or something. Remember? And he had to totally restore it. And he said the guy had to stop driving it after the market crash because every time he took it out, people were throwing rocks at him.
Because they were in tough times, and they saw this fancy car.
And they saw this fancy car.
Mm-hmm. Well, we should at least point out, at least until Sunday, Europe should be stable, which is great. Listen to these polls, though, real
quickly.
This is amazing. This is, again, like Marine Le Pen, the kind of fascist person, is on the right in the top. She's second in this one. 24, 22.5, 19.5, 19.
Wow.
And there's four different pollsters that have it almost exactly the same way. Four candidates that close together.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury.
The Glenn Beck Program.
They're more comfortable with that. We're just looking at these numbers in France. I don't think Le Pen wins. If it becomes a runoff between the communist and the fascist, I think the communist wins.
That's what The Economist believes as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, but the best scenario is you get the French Republican and the French Democrat, if you will, and those two win.
The best scenario isn't the communist winning?
Yeah, and it's not the fascist winning. But if Le Pen is number two and then there's just a bad politician as, you know, the other one, the bad politician will win against Le Pen. Not sure about
this
with the communists, though.
The Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Glenn Beck Program. We're going to take you right now to the School of Greatness. Let's go.
fusion of entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
School of Greatness, one of the top podcasts, over 30 million downloads. Detail magazine calls Lewis Howes one of the five internet gurus who can make you rich. Named one of the top 100 entrepreneurs under 30. At 33, he has built and sold several multi-million dollar online businesses. And here's the reason why he's on this program. He's from Ohio. He went from having a dream of being a professional football player. It ended in a snap, if you will, of his arm or wrist. He went from making $200, $250 a week, having food stamps so he had food on the weekend, to living on his sister's couch for 2 years.
Year and a half.
Yeah. 2 years later, making over $1 million a year. Yeah. And it's all because of a mindset. And I want to pick up the conversation. We don't like to bring people in until they sit down in the chair as we're introducing them. But a mistake happened, and he sat down in the chair, and we started talking. And this is going to be a frank and open conversation. Mm-hmm. Because yeah. He sat down and he said something about my story that you read up about my story.
Yeah, well, I'm so inspired by what you've created, and I'm always curious about the origin story of someone who's so driven, so successful, and who has a massive impact in the world. Usually when someone has a huge impact on a lot of other lives, something happened or right. A series of events happened.
Correct. That drives them. And we were talking about my mom's suicide, and he said, well, I don't have that, but...
Yeah. But I was sexually abused when I was five. I was raped by a man that I didn't know. It was the babysitter's Ooh. Son. Mm-hmm. By eight, my brother went to prison for 4.5 years, right. selling LSD to an undercover cop. My parents were always arguing and fighting and eventually got divorced. And I was bullied in school because I was a special needs learning disability student. You know, I had dyslexia, hard to read and write. I learned through sports.
Did you hear that Stu... He had his front quarter panel that he had to replace in his car. When was that? About the 1998?
Yeah, I mean, insurance covered it, but yeah.
Right. I mean, so please stop your whining, man. Stop your whining.
Yeah.
So, you know what? I am really inspired by people who, I like pivot points, you know? Mm-hmm. Pivot points tell me everything you need to know about a man. Because life is not about what happens to you. I know that sounds trite, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's about that moment that you say, I'm at the brink. I'm right here on the edge. And I'm either going to jump off, or I'm either going to fall off and die, or I'm going to jump because I've got an idea and I want to do a different thing.
Yeah.
What was your pivot point? Where was your... low point?
Well, there's many. I think for whatever reason, the moment that just came up for me is when I was picked last in elementary school playing a dodgeball game. Now, on the playground, right? I was picked last. It was two captains, two guys in my class. They picked all the guys on the team except for me, and then they started picking all the girls.
Oh, boy.
And I remember I was the last pick by default to get on a team. And at that point, it was probably like third or fourth grade. And I was like, at that point, I'm never going to be picked last again. I'm going to train my body, my mind, whatever, to be the best that I can be so that this never happens.
Wow. See, that's what happened. Because I just continued to be picked last. I just kind of went dead inside.
Yeah.
But that's an interesting choice to make.
I mean, that was a moment in time. And now it's like, you know, it's so long ago. But there were so many moments where I just continued to try to improve myself. Whenever something bad happened, I was like, okay, what can I do? This is feedback for me. How can I be better? How can I improve my life? And so my vision was to be a pro athlete. You know, that was my goal, was to be in pro sports, because that's all I really knew how to do. I wasn't good in school, so I was like, what's the other option? If I can get paid to play football and hang out with my buddies, awesome.
Right.
So I just trained every single day to do that.
And you really didn't pay attention in school? You didn't?
I tried, but it's just like I couldn't consume the information and retain it. So it didn't matter how many tutors I had, how much I studied. It was just exhausting. I would read a page over and over for 20 minutes and I couldn't remember what I was reading. So it was just really challenging. And it was terrifying for me to read out loud. Whenever the teacher would say, okay, read aloud, and have us stand up in front of class, I would just miss the simplest words. So it was just like intimidating. It was scary. It was just
humiliating.
I was already being picked on. So I was like, I couldn't wait till the bell at 3:30 to go on the sports team and just like let it
so
all out.
So you were the stereotypical, I mean, yes. You know, dumb
and,
jock.
Yeah, I was. I was. And it was challenging, but I found kind of my niche in school where I was like, okay, I was accepted because I became pretty good in high school.
Okay. So then you didn't get into the NFL.
I didn't.
You got into arena football.
Played arena football.
You're making $250 a week.
Yeah.
It's a little different than the NFL.
A lot different. It was so brutal because every week they're bringing in new guys who have a dream to play and to move up to the NFL. And so there's like no rules in the arena football league, pretty much. It's like Bush League. I mean, people are going so hard. They're doing any cheap shots they can. It's like the referees don't really care. There's, you know, it's like the Wild Wild West of football. It's mm-hmm. so physical. You're pretty much landing on concrete every single play. Mm. And there's walls. You're just constantly getting banged up. It's intense.
You break your wrist.
I played wide receiver. So I dove into the wall trying to catch a ball and snap my wrist.
That's it.
I did not, which made it worse. So it's like I broke my wrist, I dropped the ball, and felt humiliated.
Does it count as a drop when you break your wrist? I don't think it does.
No, I think it does. Yeah.
Incomplete pass.
Well, arena football is interesting in that, like, the wall is the sideline.
That's it.
Right?
Yeah.
And so
the indoor war, baby.
It's surprising more guys don't do that.
Yeah.
You get hurt like that.
So then you go from, you know, making $250 a week to making nothing, living on food stamps.
Yeah. And I was in college debt. I didn't graduate college yet. This was in 2007 when I got injured. So 10 years ago in August.
Oh, good. And then you're right up to the financial crash in Ohio.
Exactly.
So that's good.
I don't have a college degree because I left early to go try to make the NFL draft. You know, I didn't really have any skills besides playing football, but that was gone now. And again, 2008 or 2009, they weren't hiring for people that had MBAs and degrees in the first place, so I was out of luck. And a mentor of mine, you know, my sister, bless her heart, she just let me crash there for a long time and eat her macaroni and cheese or leftover food that she had. And I was living off about 3 credit cards at the time because I didn't have any money coming in.
Okay, hang on just a second. Yeah. Were you at that point... were you still this bright-eyed guy that you are now, or were you depressed and like, I'm just not going to make it?
A little bit of both.
Okay.
I was depressed and sad that my, in denial that my career was over, and I thought I was going to come back.
Right.
I was in a cast, so I broke my wrist. They took a bone out of my hip right here, put it in my wrist because the bone had crumbled so much, so they couldn't put a screw in it. So I have a big scar here from the hip surgery, and I was in a cast from here to here for 6 months.
From his shoulder to his fingertips.
Shoulder to the finger. So my fingers could move, my thumb was tight, so I could just do this.
And so anybody who's coming or going, you're like,
high five, baby.
You're like,
yeah.
Hey, see ya.
What's up, guys? You know the movie Rookie of the Year? Did you guys ever see that baseball movie? No?
Yeah.
The kid had an arm cast and he had superhuman strength afterwards. Yeah.
Right.
I didn't have that. I was like Gumby arm, right?
So is that not a documentary? Because that...
no, surprisingly. That, I believe, is a Disney movie.
Oh, okay. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So 6 months like this, on my sister's couch, no money, you know, no college degree, 2008, 2009. And it was just kind of, I thought I was going to be able to come back. I was like, I'm going to be able to make it. I'm strong enough. And after the cast came out, it was another year of me kind of recovering just so I could bend the elbow and the wrist to get it to a certain amount of strength. So I realized, like, okay, I'm probably not going to be able to go back to the Arena League and make $250 a week and then make it to the NFL 1 year. It's just 2-3 years later, it's not going to happen. You know, it was already like a tough spot for me.
Is that a tough moment of realization?
It was really tough. Yeah. It took years for me to overcome, like, the feeling every, you know, fall that came around the football season. It was hard to watch the game because I would play against guys who were in the NFL. Mm-hmm. It was like, oh, they're making it. And look at the money they're making. And look at the opportunities. And look at me here.
So Jeffy's son was in the NFL.
Oh, yeah?
And was out with an injury.
Yeah, ended with an injury after a year. It's the same
and how was
kind
his,
of feeling.
How was his emotions?
At the end, it's very difficult. It's been like 3 years now.
It's your identity. It's what you wrap your whole life up in. Mm. And so when you don't have your identity anymore, that's shaken. It's hard to move forward and feel confident.
I think that happens. I mean, I'll be real honest with you. This is, you know, this will be everywhere. Stu is saying don't say
this. I know where you're going. I know, but it's just not, there's no point in going to where you're going.
You don't even know where I'm going.
Yes, I do.
No, you don't.
I've known you for too long. Now I know where you're going.
Yes, we do. Don't.
All right. No, yesterday, Tucker Carlson takes Bill O'Reilly's slot.
Mm.
well, you know, I was at 5 o'clock, and then the 5 o'clock show moved up to 9 o'clock, and Tucker moves to 8. All great stuff. I'm so thrilled for all of them. I really am. And I wouldn't go back to Fox. I don't want to go back.
Mm.
But it is a weird thing to see, you know, would have been, could have been, whatever. And it plays with you. It does play with you. But I think that happens in everybody's life. Whatever it is you do, you see good people that you like. And you're like, I wonder if I could have. I've done it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's
there's
hard.
A guy that is still, there's a guy I played against in college named Pierre Garçon, who's still playing wide receiver. And I remember I played against him. They were the national champions. I went to a small D3 school, and he was like this stud at this other, you know, D3 school. We were kind of the powerhouses in the division. And I broke all these school records against him. He didn't even do that well. And at the end of the game, he goes, "You're the best wide receiver I've ever seen." And I was like, wow, okay. This guy who's playing in the NFL for 10 years saying this to me, it was like, huh, it was like, what could have happened?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what if I just made like one practice squad and got like about one shot and caught a touchdown and they were like, okay, we're going to keep you for a 2-year contract. You never know.
This is where most people break down.
Yeah.
Because they can't get past that whatever. Mm-hmm. They just can't get past. And it turns into something really nasty. And they end up sitting on the couch being bitter and angry and whatever.
Yeah.
So I want to take a quick break and then come back and then find out, so what pushed you off the couch? What's different about you that we can all find in ourselves that says, it doesn't matter. Right. I'm moving forward. Back in just a second, Lewis Howes. LewisHowes.com is his website, his podcast, School of Greatness, and his upcoming book, The Mask of Masculinity. More with Lewis coming up in just a second.
This is
the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Talking to Lewis Howes, he is a guy who went from making $250 a week, living in his sister house on her couch, to earning $1 million a year in 2 years. A guy who struggled his whole life, and I mean, don't anybody complain around him about, oh, my life has been so hard. You've had a rough life.
Yeah, I've had a rough life, but I think also, you know, I had a home that, with the roof over it growing up, I had food, I went to, you know, public schools, so there's always perspective. I've traveled all over the world, as I'm sure you have, and seen the worst of the worst.
Mm-hmm.
So even though on the outside it maybe didn't look that bad, I think we all have our own inner battles we have to face, so, and that's what I was dealing with.
What is it that makes you different and those who are truly great to reach their potential, whatever that potential is.
Yeah.
What is the difference between you and the ones that just get stuck on their sister's couch and just like, I'm a loser, or I'm not going to make it, or the world is against me?
I think a combination of things. And there must be some type of like disease in me that has a drive. I don't know. But there was a lot of challenges that I faced. And I think I could have either said, I'm done with things, I'm just going to be a loser and sleep on my sister's couch forever. But I just felt like something always inside of me said there was more. There was always a catalyst that would open me up and say there's something greater for my life. I remember when I was 16, my dad actually bought me tickets for me and my mom to go see Tony Robbins. Hmm. And whether you love him or hate him or any opinion about him.
He's amazing.
I think he's incredible. Mm-hmm. And when I was 16 is when I first kind of was aware of who he was. And I went to this event in St. Louis, Missouri. And it was, he had all these other Super Bowl champions there. Donald Trump was actually there, Larry King, all speaking about how to achieve essentially greatness. And I don't remember anything that anyone said, but I remember at one point, Tony got off the stage and walked down. I was about maybe halfway back the middle of the arena, and he walked down, and I'm near the aisle. He walked down and he came right next to me and stood there. And I don't remember a thing he said, but I remember like the presence that he had and the energy he had and the way he made me feel. And it was so magnetic and powerful, his energy. I was like, one day I want to be able to stand in front of an auditorium like this and move people forward in their life, whether I say something or just presence or something, be a catalyst. And I had that moment when I was 16 that I was like, I want to at least do something that is good to the world.
Have you met him yet?
I've had him on my show 3 times.
Good for you.
Yeah, I've met him many
Good
times.
Good for you.
But so I told him that story the first time I interviewed him. I was like, you know, you were a big catalyst. And I was like, I can't remember what you said to me, but your presence showed me what was possible for my life.
How did he respond to that?
He was touched. Yeah, he was appreciative of that. And then he asked to come back on 2 more times. So
okay, so you're sitting in your sister's living room, and you had to have felt, because of the upbringing and you know, everything else, that, you know, I don't have the degree. I don't have the skills.
Smarts.
Yeah. What am I going to do?
You know, the first thing that happened is, a couple of things. I just started reaching out to people that inspired me. I said, okay, the only thing I know really is sports. And the only way I got to being good in sports was by having a coach. That was it. So I said, how can I apply what I learned in sports into life, whether that's relationships or business or anything? So I started reaching out to mentors who were successful in business, and I said, what should I do? And more importantly, I asked them, how did you get here? How did you become successful? What was the path that you had? And these mentors were so instrumental in my next couple of years, because they showed me the way. They showed me a model of success that all I had to do was say, okay, put me on the practice field, tell me what to do every single day. I can put in the reps. I can work hard. I just needed to know the model of how to get there. And at the time, this cast that I had for 6 months was really annoying. And has anyone ever had a cast on, either leg or arm or anything?
No.
It's miserable, right? Mm-hmm. Smells, it gets dirty. Yeah, it was like, you know, it's scratching my body. It's like ripping my clothes, everything. I had to cut off the sleeves because it was so big. So I had like, you know.
I have that trouble with my arms, right? Sometimes.
Welcome to the gun show.
I know. Anyway, go ahead.
And so I remember just saying, like, how can I solve this problem? Like, here's my current problem is, how can I solve this problem with this cast? It smells, it looks bad, it's like scratchy, everything. And so I thought of an idea. I was like, what if I invent something that solves this problem, that's a solution? So I went on, I think it was Alibaba.com, and I said, I need like a long sweatband that I can put over this. But there was no like long sweatbands, so I designed it and sourced it from China. And so I had these long sweatbands, and it didn't fit over the whole thing, so I was like, I need a longer one, and it gets wider, and it needs a thumb hole. And so I designed this essentially cast cover that was soft, and I was like, what if I do it in different colors? There's people who have this challenge every day when they have cast. So I had this invention, and I was like, okay, well, how do I bring this thing to market? Because I have no clue how to promote anything, how to sell anything, how to get it in retail. And I found an inventor. This was one of my first mentors. I found an inventor in Columbus, Ohio, who had brought many products to market, a brilliant guy. And I showed him this thing. I said, here's something I've already done. I don't know how to get it to the next steps. And I pretty much pestered him for like 6 weeks and said, please show me the way. Every day I would show up and say, please, I'll do whatever you tell me. Like, I'll work for you for free. I'll do anything. I just want to learn how to like make this problem.
Okay, so hang on, because I got to take a break.
Yes.
I want to stop here. And when we come back, tell me the difference between going to him and saying, I have this idea, I need money, and going to him the way you did.
Yes.
Back in a second.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Lewis Howes from lewishowes.com. He's written The School of Greatness. He's got podcast School of Greatness. New book coming out, The Mask of Masculinity, which I'd love to talk to you about, but I think we're going to run out of time. He's a guy who was at the bottom of the barrel, and don't whine about your life to Lewis. 8th grade, you go to a boarding school, you're testing at a 2nd grade reading level, and you didn't have any grand turnaround in the school smarts department, right?
No, I was always below a 2.0 GPA.
Okay, so, you know, 5 years ago, he's making $250 a week, living on his sister's couch, and he has a decision to make. He has an idea about a cast cover.
Yes.
And you go to an inventor. You get it done.
I get it done.
And you go to the an inventor who has brought these things to market.
Yep.
And you're not asking, because here's the big difference.
Mm-hmm.
People come to me all the time and say, I have an idea. I need you to do this idea. It's worth $1 million. Well, I've got $1 million ideas myself. Mm-hmm. I don't need your idea.
Yep.
I want to see what you've done.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can help you, you know, through, you know, counsel or whatever to help you do it, great.
Right.
That's the secret with what I think you've done.
Yeah.
You didn't go and say, I need your investment.
No, I did not. And this is something I learned early on, because I was actually using LinkedIn a lot to reach out to people. And I learned quickly, you got a story about LinkedIn?
LinkedIn is the bane of our existence. Oh, right.
Well, perfect. Yeah. I started reaching out to people early on and realizing, like, what gets a response when I ask a question? Mm-hmm. Based what doesn't get a response? And I used to ask people for advice, and I said, I want to get a response. And when I started shifting it to saying, I'm so curious about how you became successful and what you did, I would love to learn how you did it. As opposed to asking them for advice, I said, tell me how you became successful. Everyone wants to talk about their success. And they're giving me the advice through that story.
Correct. And they're not asking you, you're not asking
for something.
Yeah.
You're giving them something.
When you say, I want your advice, well, that implies you want me to listen to your story and mm-hmm. see what you're doing and then get involved in what you're doing.
Yes.
I don't have time.
You don't have 10 minutes to go have coffee every day, right? They ask you constantly.
Right, right.
You don't have that time. So I started reframing it and just said, I'm just curious about when you transitioned from this job to that thing, or when you started this business, like, how did you do that? It seems so inspiring. I would just come from a different place. I would frame it differently.
What did your response rate go from?
From like 20% to 90%.
Okay.
Yeah. But I learned how to optimize my profile. That's a whole nother story.
I have to tell you, this is the difference. This is you're the future. This is the kind of people that businesses mm-hmm. and people who look at the future are going to hire.
Mm.
I don't care about your schooling. I don't care about your reading level. I don't care about any of that.
You care about results.
And listen to the wisdom that you have. You are
the process.
Yeah. You are looking at something and you're figuring your way out.
Yeah.
You are really smart.
Thank you.
You're just not smart the way school says.
Exactly.
Yeah. Right.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And so when I connected with this inventor, I said, listen, I've already got this. I met him with the cast cover over my arm already. And mm-hmm. I said, here's my invention. I just sourced it from China. I had the only money I had was like $75. And that was like the shipping cost. It was like just getting on a shoestring, trying to figure this out, just to get a sample. And I was like, here's what I have. I remember I had a backwards beanie cap on. I had like baggy jeans. I was like this, you know, arena football like thug essentially. Mm-hmm. But I was like, I'm hungry to create something. I'm hungry to make an impact, to create something that could help myself, but also other people who've gone through a challenge, broken their arm because it's not comfortable. So how can we bring some solution to people in discomfort?
Mm-hmm.
And he was like, I love it, but I just don't have time for you, kid. You know, he was like, I love your passion. I love this thing, but I don't have time for you. So I just like hounded him every single day. And I was like, I will do whatever it takes. I'll work for you. I'll sweep floors. Like, I don't care. I'll do whatever it takes just to get a little bit of information on what I can do to take this to market. Because I just wanted to make some money and to help myself and help other people. And I remember him saying vividly, it's funny you said this about $1 million ideas. He said to me vividly, you know, there's no such thing as $1 million idea, only $1 million executions.
Yep.
And I was like, awesome, I'll do whatever it takes. I'll execute on whatever you say. And it became a great partnership. You know, I became a mentor, or he became a mentor of mine. I was a mentee, and I worked in his kitchen. They had like a little closet for me. I worked in the kitchen. I was on the phone helping him sell his other products, go to trade shows. So I learned the business of taking an idea that we have and bringing it through idea iteration process to market. From the branding, the storytelling, everything I learned in that kind of year and a half time frame with him working on this cast comfy thing. The cast thing never worked out, but I learned so much. It was like my PhD of like business and marketing that I could have never learned at school because I was working on real world things. We were going to trade shows and I was connecting with other leaders and I was like, what do they want? What are the products they're looking for? What are the things that make them tick? And so for me, it was like, I can understand people, But like understanding a textbook is a foreign language.
So it's so funny because now you've written a book.
Yeah. It's funny because I went back to my high school, which I went to a private boarding school in St. Louis, Missouri. And I went back there a couple of years ago after I wrote this book and I hit the New York Times bestseller list. I was like, to my English teacher, who I almost flunked out of English in high school. And she was like, you need to pass a certain grade, otherwise you're not gonna be able to play football in college. So luckily she stood by me and she worked with me many hours after mm-hmm. class. And I came back to her and I showed her my book. I said, would you ever think that I would first write a book and be a New York Times bestseller? And she goes, I always believed in you. And so for me, it was like powerful to know that there are teachers that care.
Yeah.
And even if I was challenged in school, I think she believed in me in any way that I was going to do something good. So for me, it's been an amazing journey, and I feel very blessed. And I'm just constantly looking to get to the next level to reach more people and impact more people.
Somewhere in this audience of 8 million people, there is somebody today that is laying on their sister's couch in their own way. And they are at the day of pivot.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to them?
I'd say start with a dream. And your dreams matter because you matter. And when we don't have a dream or anything, my dream was to get off my sister's couch to start. It doesn't have to be to end world hunger. It can be, I just want to get a job. That's my dream right now. Or I want to get off the couch. When we don't have a dream, something we're striving for, it's hard to be motivated. It's hard to get up in the morning. It's hard to stay focused. It's hard to be grateful in moments of frustration and anger. And the dreams for me as a child of playing college football, of playing professional sports, was what allowed me to get through the constant struggle of being in school, being bullied, being picked on, feeling not worthy, feeling insecure, feeling stupid, whatever I had. It's what kept me going. Without that dream, there's no way I'd be here. There's no way, because I would have just allowed myself to spiral downward. So number one, get a dream. It matters because you matter.
Okay, let me just stop you right here. I'm an alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
I had a dream of stop drinking for a long time and almost hit, you know, beyond rock bottom because I just couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd hear, have a dream, you know, it has to be simple, even just stop drinking. And I would say to myself, if I heard that, yeah, dude, I have that dream. I can't do it. I try. I can't do it.
Yeah, it's tough. My brother was a smoker for 20 plus years.
Mm-hmm.
And every year I would just yell at him and scream at him and say, just stop. And he's like, he would try every simple hypnotism, the patch, whatever, the pills, whatever. And it wasn't until he had a catalyst that finally like woke him up where he stopped cold turkey about a year and a half ago. He went through a workshop, he said, and he's like, something just finally clicked where I just said, today's the day.
Me too.
So, you know, I think we don't have to achieve the dream. You know, I have a dream of still going to the Olympics. I'm on the USA national handball team. It's a side hobby of mine. And we just haven't qualified in the last two Olympics, but I'm on the team. And it's my dream. It may never happen, but it keeps me committed to staying in shape. It keeps me committed to striving to be a better human being and to overcome challenges. And so it may never happen for years.
Yeah.
But then at one point, maybe something opens up.
Yeah.
And it may never happen, but at least it keeps you from spiraling downward every single day because you're working towards it. And I think that's important.
It's interesting. I love stories like yours where you kind of come from nowhere and you were able to build these things. But I think a lot of people, when they hear them, they see like this point of success that you've been able to achieve as sort of like a destination. Like you get there and you're there.
This is why, and I don't know if anybody else felt this. This is why, and we've had great guests. This is why you're one of my favorite guests.
Thank you.
Because of this line. The cast thing didn't work out. He just blew it by.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't work.
Usually it's like, and the cast thing didn't work out. Yeah. But this is what I learned. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Because that's the way real life is. Yeah, I was really working hard on that, didn't it? But that led to this. It's when you look at life as a series of connections, a series of of epiphanies, a series of pivot points where you don't say, and the cast thing, I mean, I really believe that, and I know it can still work. You know what I mean? No, move on, man. Yeah. Move on.
And I don't know how much time we have. I'd love to share one more thing.
Yeah, we've got about 3 minutes.
Okay. About having a dream, because my entire childhood, I had these dreams in sports. You know, I wanted to be all state, and I was all state in a number of sports. I wanted to be an All-American athlete. I was a two-sport All-American athlete. I wanted to be a professional athlete. I wanted to achieve all these things, and they all happened for me. And here's the thing. I was miserable after every dream that I accomplished. Mm. Miserable. Mm. And it wasn't until about 4 years ago when I finally was like, why am I always... And then I was like, okay, well, I want to get off my sister's couch, and I want to make $5,000 a month. Now I want to make 20. I want to make 100 grand. I want to make $1 million. All these things happened for me. And I was constantly miserable. It was never enough. And I was like, okay, wait a minute. Why am I achieving my dreams and I'm the most miserable that I've ever been right afterwards, with minutes after they happen? And it wasn't until a few years ago when I realized that all these dreams, I was focused on them for myself to prove people wrong. The kid who was picked last in dodgeball. I was trying to prove the other kids wrong. Or the girl that made fun of me, or whatever. I was trying to prove people wrong that I was good enough by achieving these dreams. And it wasn't until a few years ago when I said, wow, I've been doing this all wrong. These dreams need to be for me, but also for other people. They need to make an impact on something bigger than just myself. Mm. And since then, like, it's such a relief to let go of this pressure of having to achieve dreams and then feeling unfulfilled. So everything I do now, it's to make an impact on other people. Yes, I want to go to the Olympics for myself, but I also want to do it to be a catalyst for other people, to show them what's possible if I do make the Olympics, and to inspire people with my journey. I've been trying to do it for 8 years now, and to say, hey, listen, follow me on the journey. Even if I never make it, follow the journey. And I think that's what's been a shift for me recently. I'm still growing and learning every single day. You know, I interview people every day like yourself, and I feel like, wow, there's so much to learn still. And so I'm a student of life, and I know that everything I go after, I have to do it for more than just myself.
All of this being said, Jeffy has a dream of success. He should just give up, right? Like, I mean, for him, like,
we were talking to a theologian the other day, and we were talking about heaven, and we're convinced there's no hope for him on the other side.
Right? You got a shot?
No, I believe with you.
I believe with you.
He really is optimistic.
He's lying. Lewis, great to meet you.
Yeah, thank you.
Great to meet you guys. Hope to see you again.
Yes.
Lewis Howes, get the book, School of Greatness. Listen to his podcast, School of Greatness. Lewis Howes, H-O-W-E-S, lewishowes.com, the School of Greatness. Thank you, sir.
He had 418 yards receiving in a game.
In a single game.
In a game.
Amazing.
In college.
So we didn't get to get any of the fun sports stuff. I listened to you guys go for 6 minutes during the break.
About that.
Talking about that. And as I'm sitting there, I'm thinking, the guy has a second grade reading level, and look at what he's accomplished.
Yeah,
and
you 418 guys are just like,
418
yards.
Passes for 418 yards.
Glenn Beck Program.
888-727-BACK.
Mercury.
888-727-BACK.
This is
the Glenn Beck Program.
What a remarkable guy he is, huh? And I know you're going to say 417
years.
418.
418 years.
18.
Don't cheat him.
Is that a big deal?
See, what was the all-time record for college football for several years? Yeah. Yeah, so yes, a big deal. But a really cool story. I mean, it's an amazing thing.
It's a big deal if you get 100 yards receiving in a game. So 418 is, yeah, that's a big deal.
Nice guy. Smart guy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's amazing. This is why college, getting yourself into debt for college is so worthless. You have the drive that this guy has. You know how to use critical thinking and find your way through. That's the kind of guy that makes $1 million. The people who just line up and just keep doing the same thing over and over again that everybody else is doing, it's not going to be success.
The Glenn Beck Program.
Mercury.
The Blaze Radio Network. On demand.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Glenn Beck Program. A couple things that you need to watch for this weekend. Big weekend in France. The election of France could change the course of history for the entire West. We'll explain that a little later on. Also, I have to tell you about a new movie that is opening up this weekend with Christian Bale. It's called The Promise. This movie they have been trying to make literally for 70 years, and it shut down every single time. Finally, the guy who owned MGM, on his deathbed, said, make the movie, here's the money, don't stop. And it's coming out this weekend. It's called The Promise with Christian Bale. It is really, really good. And a really good reason for you to see it, and I'll explain coming up in just a little while. Also, something else to watch for is Venezuela. This is the biggest rape and robbery of a country ever. And the press is making this into a nationalist movement. No, no, no. This is a socialist dictatorship. And you can try to repackage it any way you want, but this was a country that had hope, that Hugo Chavez and his socialist regime started to take it apart, and now the wheels have come off, and it is a humanitarian crisis that people don't really want to talk about. We have Debbie D'Souza. Debbie is Dinesh D'Souza's wife. She's from Venezuela, and we were talking about it the other day about what was happening, and we thought, you know, we got to call Debbie because her family is still there. She knows what's happening. We're going to talk a little bit about what's really going on in Venezuela and what a Marxist utopia looks like in the end, beginning right now.
Entertainment and enlightenment. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
I saw a video the other day of Venezuelan citizens walking down the street at night, literally looking for dogs so they can eat. What is happening in Venezuela is remarkable. And it is a socialist utopia the way they always end. There's a humanitarian crisis going on right now in Venezuela, some of which I can't talk to you about. There are things going on right now that people are being literally smuggled out at night because they're being targeted as groups. As I look at this and see what's going on, and now the press is starting to say, oh, you know what this is? This is what happens when you go to nationalism and populism. No, that's not what this is. This is communism. This is socialism. This is what happens. And quite honestly, this is the road that we've been headed on for a very long time. Debbie D'Souza joins us now in the program. Hi, Debbie. How are you?
Hi, Glenn. First of all, I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for talking about Venezuela for all these years. I've listened to you for years, and you have been right on target with the situation in Venezuela from the very beginning. And I want to thank you for that, because not very many people talk about it. They ignore it. You know, Venezuela is only a couple of thousand miles away from us.
I know.
And, they have not talked about it at all. And like you say, they say it's something other than what it is. And it is downright socialism. And this is what it looks like. This is the ugly side of socialism, which actually, I don't know that there's a pretty side to it. But
who was it, Thatcher, that said the problem with socialism is eventually you run out of other people's money.
Exactly.
This is that point where eventually you run out of money.
Absolutely. And Venezuela, you know, I was born in Venezuela in 1966. It was a thriving country. You know, it's an oil-rich country. So, you know, we had all of the amenities that you could think of. You know, the birth rate in Venezuela, obviously, when I was born was high. Now, you know, babies born in Venezuela, the birth rate has gone down because the death rate has gone way up for babies born, because he, you know, Hugo Chavez, as you said, destroyed the healthcare system, trying to make everybody pay for it. Well, you know, when people started leaving the country, when doctors started leaving the country, there was no one to pay for it.
And then when he had a thriving oil company,
industry,
and when he took that over and nationalized oil, that went through the ground.
He nationalized everything: telecommunications, energy. You know, the left in Venezuela is also into the whole climate change thing, and so they basically started doing wattage allotments for people. So if you went over your allotment, your allotted wattage at the end of the month, you had to pay like a 200% tax increase on top of your bill. And, you know, so people stopped using blow dryers. They stopped using, I mean, it was ridiculous. Of course, now Debbie, it's just awful.
Debbie, when you see this is a narco-communist state.
Uh-huh.
This is a communist state now that has ties to terror, ties to Iran, ties to Hezbollah.
Mm-hmm.
The current president is going to Citibank, and it's going to be one of the biggest robberies of all time, or at least this century, where he is now going to sell all of the Venezuelan gold reserve.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear people on TV say this is populism, which is clearly wrong. And clearly trying to make a point that is anti-Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
How does that make people in Venezuela feel?
Well, you know, those people that get it in Venezuela are huge Donald Trump fans. They've asked me to, you know, to tell you and the viewers, please, Donald Trump, do something. Either, you know, embolden the opposition. You know, we're not asking for military intervention. You know, it's actually that bad. But we want to embolden the opposition.
Who is the opposition that could fix this?
Well, the opposition leader right now is Enrique Capriles. It's basically made up of different political parties that are all on the right side of the ideological chart. So in other words, when COPE, which was it was basically the equivalent of the Republican Party, self-destructed, this is what gave way to Hugo Chavez. This is the reason Hugo Chavez was able to come in and take over the country, is the right of Venezuela just completely self-destructed. And so then they kind of started picking up the pieces and splintered off into a bunch of different political groups. And so they all got together and called themselves the opposition. And so Enrique Capriles basically has run for president twice. And we believe that the last time he actually won, but there was voter fraud. And so basically, it was either last week or a couple of weeks ago, they banned him from running for any type of office. I mean, can you imagine? So they are afraid of this man. So him, and then there's a woman, she's a congresswoman named Maria Corina Machado, who's also opposition party. And they have actually blamed the death of this young girl. I sent you a video, this girl who was killed by thugs who basically are helping run the country. These are called colectivos. It's basically a civilian army that Hugo Chavez established based off of criminals who he pardoned. Mm-hmm. And so they're, you know, they're murderers, they're rapists, they run amok all over the city, just, you know, killing people, raping women, doing whatever they want.
This happens, and this is why Haiti can't get back up on its feet, because they have the same kind of thing happening in Haiti.
Yes, so this is huge. The colectivos are there feared. And I don't know if you know this, but in 2010, there was a disarmament movement for citizens of Venezuela. So they started taking away guns of citizens. Mm. And so now citizens do not have guns, but these colectivos do. And also, of course, the armed forces of Venezuela is also part of the regime. So they're the National Guard, and of course they have guns, and then these thugs have guns, but the citizens don't have anything. And so I want to make it very clear that when you see, you know, fighting in the streets and these kids throwing Molotov cocktails and all of that, these aren't the same type of thugs that are like wreaking havoc here on, like, you know, the
Berkeley.
Berkeley and all that. No, this is the exact opposite. Actually, those thugs are the thugs that have the guns in Venezuela, the left. And
Debbie,
so
we're talking to Debbie D'Souza, Dinesh D'Souza's wife, who is from Venezuela. Her family is in Venezuela. I remember I was coming back from South Africa, and I was supposed to go speak in Venezuela. I don't remember, it was like the National Theater or something, and there was a group of pastors from all over Central and South America. And Hugo Chavez said, you're not going to speak there, and put armed military around. By the time I landed to refuel in North Africa, they said, don't come, the people who invited me, because he's going to put military around the theater. So I actually had to land in, I think, Jamaica, wasn't it, Pat? And we cut my message and had somebody smuggle it in on videotape into Venezuela. Now, that was 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking now. I'm dealing with people now trying to help smuggle people out of Venezuela who are being targeted as groups. I mean, dangerous place now.
It is awful. My 82-year-old aunt, and I'm only saying this, you know, I'm just throwing this out there. She's in Miami right now, but the rest of my family is still in Venezuela, and I don't know what to do. I mean, this is so bad. You know, Ted Cruz's dad, Rafael, married Dinesh and I, and I reached out to him in 2014, because this is when people started taking it to the streets back in 3 years ago. And he was trying to help. But of course, you know, it was the Obama administration was in bed with these people. And so, you know, what people don't get is Hugo Chavez hated Bush. He hated Reagan. He hates any hated any Republican, as Maduro does. And so, you know, I just don't understand how people do not see that the left uses the same exact tactics in Venezuela. They blame the right for everything that's going wrong.
This is 1950s, 60s Cuba on what's going on, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. And the other thing, too, is that Cuba basically owns Venezuela now.
Yeah.
Maduro is close friends with the Castro brothers, obviously, you know, one of them has passed away, but the other one, Raul,
yes.
They're buddy-buddy, and they are, so basically he's helping him run Venezuela. And so go ahead.
Is this something that we could see a Reagan moment, that if Donald Trump empowering, not using force, making the speech of Gorbachev, tear down this wall, and empowering, like the Pope did, the solidarity movement in Poland.
Absolutely, absolutely. The Reagan doctrine is what we want. Empowering the people that are being oppressed right now in Venezuela, the opposition party, helping them somehow, you know, reach the level of of being able to get out of this. I just don't know, short of a military coup, I just don't know how else to remove this man from office and to, you know, to help the Venezuelans. I mean, this crisis has reached a level of, I've never seen it like this before. I mean, it's just horrific.
They really are, there's no food.
And no food, nothing. I mean, these people are, for the most part, you know, they hoard food, and they grow their own food because they have to. They, you know, my aunt was going from grocery store to grocery store just to find milk, just to find eggs. You know, she basically had to go vegan. And I mean, it's really, really horrific.
Yeah, I will tell you that I've seen reports where people will line up starting at 1 o'clock in the afternoon and sometimes at midnight, hoping that there would be a delivery for the store. And when that door opens, whether you need it or not, it's Germany stuff. Whether you need it or not, you buy whatever is on the shelf.
Absolutely. And Glenn, this is also, you know, people are, you know, say, well, Debbie, you know, why should we care about Venezuela? Well, I tell you why you should care. Number one, if it's destroyed, it's going to just become a hotbed for all these terrorists that are in bed with the with the regime. They already have, you know, and this is from reports from people that are in Venezuela that tell me that they see things in Farsi. You know, there's airplanes coming from Iran that are landing from Tehran in the Maiquetía, Venezuela, Caracas airport daily. What are they doing? Yeah. Basically, they're up to no good. And so if we create, you know, this situation where there's going to be a huge vacuum in Venezuela,
it's,
you know, no telling. Yes. Yeah.
Debbie, I've got to run, but thank you so much for this update. We're going to continue to follow it, and please let us know how we can help.
Thank you.
You bet.
Trump help. I mean, I don't know. We're desperate. We are desperate.
Debbie,
thank you so much, Glenn.
Thank you. Debbie D'Souza, following on the crisis in Venezuela.
Luckily, Trump always listens to you, so.
Glenn Beck.
Mercury.
Program.
Sign up for the newsletter and get all the info you need to know at glennbeck.com.
Who knew the wonderful world of Stu has been picked up yet for another season, and tonight is the season premiere. I don't know who is in charge of this network, but we're still spending money on that.
I'd like to find that out myself.
Yeah.
We kind of exist in this no man's land that no one really cancels it or endorses it, and it just keeps going.
Well, because it's like nobody knows. There's like...
Right.
I mean,
Survivor just signed their 34th season. What season is this?
Season 7 of The Wonderful World of Stu.
Yeah, okay, and you're actually talking about Venezuela tonight.
Yes, we have a segment. It's a little bit of different handling of the crisis. However...
You're showing how you can make delicious cake out of cat food, I understand.
It's similar to that. Jeffy... stars in the particular Venezuela segment, and I think his performance just that it's worth seeing.
You think Venezuela, you think me. So.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God.
I mean, come on.
Venezuela.
If anyone could benefit from a situation in which there is no available food on the shelves of grocery stores, it's Jeff.
That's me.
No, he'll show you how to live your life.
The Venezuelan diet coming tonight. It's a new plan. And I think it will work for a lot of people.
It's really scary what's going on in Venezuela.
Sure, we played the BBC. Was it BBC's footage of
The grocery stores?
Grocery stores. It's terrifying.
Empty. There's not.
No. Literally. And
there's not a single item.
Literally,
on the shelves.
You have children. You wait in line starting at midnight. Wait in line, and you may not get anything.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You may not get anything.
Right. No, they made it illegal to start at midnight. You can't. It's daybreak now.
No, you can.
I mean, I don't think you can stand in line at night.
Oh,
anymore.
Really?
Yeah, I think they don't want people standing in line overnight. You show up at daybreak.
Yeah, it's worse than what's going on in Managua, Nicaragua.
What?
It's worse.
Where?
It's worse. Managua, Nicaragua.
Why are you? You're
white.
Accent.
You have no.
Well, do you know that a car bomb exploded in Managua, Nicaragua?
No,
he's
working on maybe taking an anchor ship at one of the local news stations.
Oh, okay.
And you have to have
when
that skill.
When you get to a Spanish word, you have to be able to say it like a Spanish person. Managua, Nicaragua.
Back in a minute.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Glenn Beck Program. Glad you are here. Let me... A good weekend. I actually get the opportunity to spend 2 days brainstorming on some ideas with some Disney Imagineers, some people who have just come back from China and are working on some things in China right now.
For Disney? Or
Yeah. Really? Some of it's for Disney, some of it's not. These guys have been with Disney for eons.
Are they opening up a theme park in China?
I think they already have.
Oh, do they?
Yeah, no, Disney is working on, in China, Disney is working on some really remarkable
things.
Right.
They had some $2 billion complex or something. Was that in China?
Yeah, they're not only building, they're not just building the resorts. They're actually, China is has gone with Disney and said, help us design the city of tomorrow. And so they're actually going back to what Epcot was supposed to be. And China is putting the resources in. And it's funny because the people who work over in China, the kind of the joke is, and I've heard this from several different people that, how is it this goes? I'm going to butcher this, but it is in America, we believe that it takes... 100 people to do one. I can't remember now. But China doesn't have a... China has this mentality now of there are no restrictions. There are no rules. Break all the rules. Think out of the box. And we can just throw people at it. And they just think that they can just get it done. And strangely, they are getting it done. And they're kind of where we used to be. And now all the restrictions are happening here. And you can't get anything done here where everything is happening in China. The Asia is way ahead.
Seems like of Trump is trying to do something about that. You know, we've lost $86 billion worth of regulations already, and he's still cutting them.
It'd be great. But I mean, remember yesterday's program. What did we have on yesterday's program? The wall can't be built because of the cheetah or the jaguar and the birds can't fly over a 30-foot fence.
Let's not forget about the Mexican gray wolf.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I mean, you know, what's amazing is Disneyland, they broke ground in 1954. And I believe it was November of 1954. I give it the benefit of the doubt. September, but I think it was November of 1954. They cut the ribbon in July of 1955.
Wow.
Can you even imagine that?
No, because it takes 4 years to get anything done now.
They bought the land.
Amazing.
They bought the land in 53.
Jeez.
You couldn't get the environmental study done. I mean, it just can't be done in America anymore. These things just can't be done in America.
Look how long it took the Freedom Tower to be built.
Yeah.
15 years almost.
Let me flip things around. There is something that has taken 70 years to make. This is the most incredible story ever because you just don't think this is possible. The Armenian Genocide happened in the early 1900s. Still today,
in Turkey,
still today, they deny it. It is where we get the word genocide.
Now, I don't think very many people even know about that.
No. It's what Hitler knew he could get away with a Holocaust because nobody paid attention to the Armenian Genocide. And Hitler said, look at what happened there. Nobody cares. And that's the Christians. They were doing it to the Christians. Nobody cares. They're not going to care about the Jews. And so he knew he could get away with it. This is the seed. And Turkey still denies it. And every president that is ever campaigning always says, I will call it genocide. They get into office and
they
then
don't.
State Department says, you can't call it genocide.
Didn't Obama promise and then not?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did. So did Bush. You know, I'm going to call it a genocide. Nope, he didn't. He didn't. So it is a genocide and it needs to be called a genocide and the story needs to be told. So a guy who was not really a filmmaker, he was more of a real estate developer, back, I think, in the 70s, bought MGM and made a lot of money off the sale of MGM. The studio system was tanking,
and he bought MGM, and then he sold off a lot of the parts, and then he sold the whole thing. And all the parts started to grow, and then it caved again, and he was like, I'll buy it. And so he bought it again. And then he sold off the parts, and then he took the name, and he said, we're going to make the MGM Grand in Vegas, and we'll try to, you know, restore the brand name for what it is, blah, blah, blah. He built it up. He sold it, and it collapsed again. He bought it, I think, 3 or 4 times, okay, from like 1968 to his death in 2004. He had bought and sold MGM like 4 times. And he made a ton of money. This movie was originally, it's called The Promise. This movie, not the way it is being shown now, the first time went in production, Clark Gable was the star.
Wow.
Okay?
Wow.
Turkey, you think of Turkey as being a nobody nation back mm-hmm. then, right? Why would we care?
There barely is somebody now. They're only somebody now because they're in NATO.
Right.
But I mean, then nobody cared about Turkey.
And really, you look at it now and say, who cares about Turkey, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So back then, they were in production with this movie with Clark Gable. And Turkey said, we will close the market for you, MGM, in Turkey, and we will close it all through the Middle East.
So?
That's what I thought.
Right.
They
folded, though.
Canceled the movie.
That's amazing.
Okay.
That's sure amazing. Is.
This movie has been off and on for decades. And nobody has ever made this movie.
Jeez.
So the guy who bought and sold MGM time and time again, he knew that. And he was also a believer that the Armenian genocide needed to be called genocide. On his deathbed, he put $100 million to this movie and said the movie can be made now and it can be made outside of the studio system. So don't worry about it. Make it. The Clark Gable character is Christian Bale. And it's called The Promise. Okay. It opens this weekend. And this is such an important movie. And you notice I'm not saying it's a film. It's being compared to Dr. Zhivago. But I have to tell you, I've watched Dr. Zhivago.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my gosh. I want to hang myself with Dr. Zhivago. That is a beautiful film.
Yeah.
This is a great movie. Okay.
And it's interesting because the critics don't like it, but the audience loves it. 47% from critics, 87% from the audience.
It is.
I think it's great.
Yeah. I think it is great. And I was, you know, when somebody does a movie and they're trying to make a point,
usually
you're like, oh, stop with the point. Just don't jam it down. Yep. They don't. It's just a good, it's not a film, not an important film to see. It's a great movie. But it is the first time. And here's the thing. Here's why I would love for this to have a huge opening weekend is Turkey is now threatening all of the theater chains saying we will boycott you if carry this movie.
I don't know about you, but
exactly.
I mean, you go, even if you're not going to go see a movie this weekend, go online right now and buy one ticket to that.
No
to
kidding.
The theater. Buy 2 tickets. Just even if you can't go, I urge you to go because it's a good movie. I mean, Christian Bale is in it. It's a good movie. And ladies, I believe he has his shirt off. I don't recall, but that can't hurt. It's a good movie. So
why does it have to be just for ladies?
I was going to say that's pretty sexist.
You know what? Wow. I'm sorry for being so cis.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Cis. Gender exactly. focus or whatever focus. That is. I feel bad about that. So
centric, cis-centric.
Cis-centric, yes. Thank you. My gosh, how cis-centric of me. Feel bad about that. I really do. It's called The Promise, a movie that has taken almost a century to make. Opens this weekend. Did you see Jake Tapper with
Sarah Palin?
Sarah Palin.
That was really interesting.
I'm going to take a break. We're going to come back with some audio. It was
fascinating mm-hmm. to watch.
He really tried to pin her down on something.
And she, I don't know what she...
Answers it in a weird way.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.
The Glenn Beck Program.
So I want to play something from Jake Tapper. I'm going to give you my analyst view on what this means. Pat has been puzzled by it all day today. I think I know what it means, but I could be wrong. I'm just guessing. Listen.
They're talking about the sexual harassment there.
Ever witness or
Jake Tapper, Sarah Palin.
God forbid, anything like that at Fox?
I wouldn't put up with anything that would be perceived as intimidating or harassing.
But you said you're former, so I wonder, was that part of the reason you left?
You can ask them why I'm no longer with Fox.
Is that weird for her to stumble around? Is that one of the reasons you left Fox?
So how do you read that, Pat? Before you know, before we spoke, how would you read that?
That she's maybe hedging that it's possible something happened.
So let's go through the history of Sarah Palin.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah Palin changed, in my view. What week, Pat? The week something big in the news happened.
I don't remember what week
Gabby
it
Giffords.
Was.
It was the week I was called to Roger Ailes' office. I don't think we've ever spoken about this on the air. Maybe we'll talk about it some other time. and I...
probably a good idea.
A miracle happened as they were trying to get their thumb on top of me. And as I left the office, I heard Roger scream, "Get Palin on the phone." And I don't think that miracle happened. And if you remember right, Fox smeared her, but always claimed, we don't know anything. I don't know who did that. Oh my gosh. Well, you'll just have to ask Sarah about that. I don't know. Personally, yep. I don't think she was hit on. They're far too smart okay. to do that.
And then if you are, with that in mind, it's interesting to hear how she phrases things kind of just that way.
I'm not going to speak for them. My contract wasn't renewed. That's true. That's okay. the line.
I don't want to be
that's
the jerk.
The
that
line.
Like
that's the line.
That's the line.
You know, it was just time to part ways and get out there in a more diverse arena to express views mm-hmm. and to speak for the
okay,
public.
Okay, so stop. Here's what happened.
She said, "You'll have to ask Fox why I'm not there anymore."
Right. So here's what happened. My guess is Fox News, they collect things. They collect people. Roger did. Once Roger felt she's no longer necessary to collect, let her go out someplace else. She's not worth the hassle, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. He just doesn't renew her contract. That's the line. That's the line. Now, while that's happening, if you go back in time and you think, gee, I think there were some smear things that seemed like they were coming from Fox, but no, Fox would never do that. Smear things coming out. Mm-hmm. So what happens? She is put in a position to where she could clearly say, No, I never saw that.
I never saw anything like that.
Never saw that.
Which she sure didn't do there.
Or she can answer honestly, I don't know why my contract was, you'll have to ask them. You'll have to ask them. Did she see something? I don't think so. I think they're too smart to do that
it's
to
more
Sarah Palin.
Just a dig back at
I them. Think that is a, oh, two can play at this game. You know what? You'll have to ask them. The line is, my contract wasn't renewed.
That's a pretty good thought.
Really
good
interesting.
Theory. Huh.
All right. Go see The Promise this weekend. I promise you won't regret it. Great movie. Important movie. But it's a movie, not a film. The Promise.
This is the Glenn Beck Program. Mercury.